Okay, so I'm Rick Hansen. It's March 6th, 26th, April. It's really funny. I wonder sometimes if it's an affectation, but it's genuinely not. I think I'm senility and being in the moment. Hopefully more the latter than the former, but anyway, this is, you know, it's literally like a mild learning disability I have, locating things in time. I have to work at it. My wife's a genius at it, thank God. But anyway, so that's, today is April 6th, 2016. And I want to talk about embodiment and incarnation, to use a fancy word, as a way of framing mindfulness of the body, and especially as I depart temporarily, you know, giving you maybe a frame or some things to practice with meanwhile. So I want to start with a story. One of the most important experiences of my life I'm going to tell you about. I was probably about 26. It was, I think, about 1977. And I was living in Germany at the time, my second near year in Europe. The first one was in Finland when I was in 15 or so. And at that time, I was working for what I think of as half a cult. It was called Earth Play, if you want to search for it. It was a kind of spin-off of Est, although Est didn't create it or anything. And it had a couple of charismatic people who were in charge of it. Unusual for cults, the primary leader was a woman. And it had a lot of good things in it. It was very strong in the human potential movement, but it had its cultic features of a kind of very insular tightness, a willingness, frankly, to exploit people for the sake of the organization and its leaders, its founders. And I was, to some extent, complicit in that as a participant in this organization, as someone who was involved in its sort of business side in Germany, and also involved to some extent in recruiting people for it and doing some of its teaching. So it's one of these complex, messy things you find yourself in sometimes in your mid-20s, if not later in life or before then. In any case, what had started to happen for me was that I began getting really quite upset and depressed, I think, about a variety of things. And I started feeling so miserable that I began really reflecting on this fundamental question, why keep on living? And it wasn't that I was actively suicidal or clinically depressed, but the shocking possibility, the shocking reality that at any point, suddenly my world could change as it had changed. I'd left America, I'd left my friends behind, I'd left what I had done mainly behind, and I was really kind of spinning in space over here, feeling miserable. And it was like, wow, if at any moment you could feel miserable, why live? You know, why? And it was a real reflection for a while. And the turning point came for me when I literally was walking home from the laundry, carrying my boss's fancy suits. And I was mulling this, and I paused, and I can visualize where I stopped, and I was reflecting about all this. And it suddenly came to me, like one of those very powerful realizations in which a lot of stuff is condensed together, that I had not really fully chosen to be in this life. I hadn't. I could, you know, I enjoyed this life, but I had a kind of ambivalent relationship to it. You know, the story is you're standing on the edge of a dock and you're deciding whether to get on a boat that's next to the dock. So you put one foot on the boat to check it out, right? And at first it's really fine because you're right like this, but then the boat starts moving away from the dock. 1 foot, 2 feet, 3 feet, 4 feet, and then you go, wow, if it's this bad to have 1 foot on the boat, it must be terrible to have two, I better get back on the dock. So I had that kind of relationship with this life. And there was a lot about that that had to do with my family. I've had other experiences where maybe there was something about birth. I really wasn't happy about coming out. You know, I liked it in there. It was cozy, dark, nobody was really bothering me, yapping at me, no bright lights, no pain. I wasn't really all that happy about getting shoved out the birth canal and all the rest of that. So all that really came together for me in one moment, several dozen seconds of kind of realization. And it was right there for me. Do I choose to be in this life? Do I choose to incarnate in this life? To really commit to being on the game board? Reserving the option that with a terminal illness, intractable pain, stuck in the equivalent, let's say, of Auschwitz, something like that, I'm reserving the rights to leave if I want to. But other than that, to be wholly committed, to coming into this life. And what happened for me right there was that I really made a fundamental choice to come into this life. It's about 26. And it's been the case for me ever since. It's a really profound turning point. A lot of things shift when you're wholly committed. They're beautiful quotes from people like Goethe or Theodore Roosevelt about what happens when you become wholly committed. You go all in. You reserve your rights, but meanwhile, you're wholly engaged. You're fully engaged. And so I want to invite you to reflect on yourself about your own relationship to embodiment and really, really choosing to be here if you are here. And you are here. I can see you. And you might, maybe for you this has not been an issue at all. On the other hand, I think for a lot of people, they're not so sure about sticking around, and anything they do is sort of provisional or tentative or ambivalent or half-hearted, or they're, holding back for the final battle or something, And part of the process of incarnation, I'm really trying to talk about it in a very psychological way. There may be other aspects to it. I think there were in my case about not being that excited about coming back into a body yet again, maybe something about that. But whatever might be true about that, just purely psychologically, it was really clear for me that I had not really, I wasn't living from a clear choice at a fundamental level to be here. And part of being here is being in the body, embodiment. Coming into the body. And whatever might be true in this more kind of radical, fundamental framework I'm starting with here, meanwhile, for very ordinary reasons and reasons that are well known in psychology, people, me included, tend to not fully inhabit their own bodies. One of the main reasons is that the body's uncomfortable. There's pain there. Physical pain, for sure, but also lots of emotional pain. And emotion involves body sensation. So one of the fastest ways that the brain knows how to shut down discomfort is to tune out the body. Numb the body, sedate the body, dissociate from the body. Dissociate means you just kind of leave it. It's a major response to trauma. There's subtler forms of dissociation where we just feel kind of spacey, or not that clear, or sleepy, or just not that present, or confused, subtler forms of dissociation. We're not associated with the body, we're disassociated. And so to be mindful of the body as a practice is, of course, to push into and in some sense against that learning, that conditioning that tunes out or numbs out or sedates the body. One way we sedate the body is by with food, carbohydrates, or alcohol, or drugs, or overwork. That's a very wonderful way, I know it quite well, to sedate the body. You just exhaust it. You just are so caught up in mental effort. What body? Right? For a long time I felt like my body was just this, long-suffering, very sturdy horse just kind of carrying me around. And quite actually, one reason I'm on a so-called sabbatical this year is because over a year ago, my body started talking to me and saying, dude, what's with the spurs? I'm going to buck you off if we don't start chilling out. I want my meadow. I want my pasture, you know. I want my oats. I've had it with you sitting up there on my back, goading me on to the next accomplishment, the next ambition, the next achievement. Okay? So there are a lot of ways to tune out. I invite you into a reflection about your own ways, whatever they may be, to not fully inhabit your own body, to withdraw attention perhaps from parts that hurt, understandably, to pull attention away from what I believe Antonio Damasio coined the term somatic markers, the body sensations that are associated with difficult emotions or relationships or experiences, to pull away. Be aware of that. Reflect on that. And see what's possible for you about waking down, as Samuel Bonder puts it, not just waking up, coming down into. So before I go any further, I just kind of invite some comments, maybe examples of ways that people who need not be yourself, you can see it out there, or maybe you'll talk about it for yourself as well. People tune out. Why they tune out, how they tune out, you know, how they're not engaged with the body. One other major factor is people who don't like their body or they feel embarrassed about their body. One of the things that our daughter has really educated my wife and me to, because we kind of came up through the 60s and 70s, is the ways in which many people, women, girls, females, to the extent that category is meaningful, in general have a lot of, there's a lot of communication about you're just not all right with the body that you've got. I remember my own experiences as a very young guy in junior high school, having skipped a grade with a late birthday, late to puberty, taking showers with the other guys. Whoa, that was like, uh-oh, something wrong with me. It all turned out eventually all right in the end. But anyway, Mother Nature does have her ways. So you might, you know, so I'll just pause here for a moment. What are some of the ways that you have seen others? It's okay to talk, you know, or yourself. Disengage from the body, yeah.
Yeah, I have more of a question, and that's people who really work out a lot. I mean, I can see how that can bring you into your body, but I'm wondering if maybe that is disassociating sometimes. It's overdone.
That's an interesting comment.
I don't know. I'm just curious.
Yeah, do you see that? Is that what you're saying? Like, the body's not okay as it is, so I'm going to perfect it to the point of steroid rage and stuff like that? That's what you mean?
I'm not sure. I just see some people who just work out every day. And I'm thinking, is that putting them in their body, or are they somehow disassociating themselves out from their body?
I don't know. What are some ways that you see? Yeah, Lily.
Well, mine's a question, too, because I don't really understand what you mean in terms of being in your body. Because I absolutely can't understand that. I mean, I feel like I'm in my body. I mean,
yeah.
So what do you
That's very good, Lily. I really appreciate that. So I thought about that and how to speak to that. So first of all, can you place attention in every single part of your body and track the sensations there at will? Can you put your attention in your left little toe? Can you bring attention to your diaphragm? Can you feel your back? Can you rest attention and tune into the sensations in every part of your body? Or are parts of your body markedly number or harder to locate attention in? And some classic places to look are where people hold tension or where trauma can happen. You know, the diaphragm related to breathing. Can you really tune in there? The pelvic floor, the base of the pelvis, where all those, you know, delicate systems are. Can you locate attention in your internal organs? Can you feel your lungs expanding and contracting? Can you feel your heartbeat? These are just questions, you know, and there's a lot of wonderful training around Charlotte Selver and others around sensory awareness, because a lot of people are not that able to just drop attention when they're sitting quietly or standing or something. So that's a first inquiry. And if the answer is not yes, there's some wonderful simple trainings a person can do, including just progressive relaxation, where you very systematically, or do a body scan, like in mindfulness-based stress reduction or other things. That's one. Two, can you remain really tuned into your body while you're moving? Okay? Can you remain very mindful as you reach for the cup? You know, can you remain very mindful as you walk? Can you remain really mindful of your body as you're doing some kind of mental work? And these are just inquiries and places to expand, to grow, to learn. I think of them as competencies. It's okay if we don't do it all the time, but it will. Can you remain tuned into your body while you're writing a music review?
But why would you want to?
Well, that's a different question.
But
well, let's do one question at a time. So let's operationalize what we're talking about. Is that right? So you can see that, okay?
It's a long process you're talking about. You're talking about fragmented parts and emotions and transformation. There's more to it. Sages don't listen to their body; they listen to God. They don't. That's free will. We don't hand over our free will. It's a spiritual thing. I mean.
Oh, okay. Whoa. You've said so many good and big things.
I did all that and I'm still working on it. It's hard, Rick.
Oh yeah. Okay. All right. We got like 5-6 things, all these great dishes on the table before us, but one at a time. So we'll do one at a time. Okay? So back to the just finishing out questions about being in the body. Also, in addition to the movement part, can you track the somatic markers of when you're interacting with others or when you're having intentions? Can you feel the physical sensation aspects of intention or wanting or sadness or anger or love or subtle attitudes, you know, in real time? I think of it as like a music. You know, can you pick out the bass guitar while you're listening to the music? It may be subtler, and yet it's interesting. Actually, I had a friend who played the bass guitar, and he pointed out, he said, in many ways, the bass guitar is the fundamental instrument in certainly a lot of music. It's really, it's where the gut lives. It's interesting, isn't it? So can you track your own subtle things, the tension in your body when you're irritated with somebody, you know? Can you do that? Stay here. Can you do these things? If you can't, you're incompetent. I'm using that word deliberately. You'd lack a competency. And the separate question is that competency valuable? And another question back there is, how is that competency acquired? And then also, beautiful, important question, you know, how does that competency relate to the transcendental, let's say? You know, et cetera, et cetera. But let's just kind of clarify what we mean, you know. And then another question related to mindfulness of the body. So we have, can you tune into any part of your body you want to at will and sustain attention to it? Another is, can you track movement and stay in the body, tuned in to all of it, the inside of your thighs, you know, the back, the areas we tend to leave out. Can you do that while you move? Also, can you track the somatic markers, the underlying physical sensations that correlate with, that go along with, you know, the flow of thought and emotion, memory and desire? Are you that tuned in? Now, you may not want to be, but that's a real opportunity, you know. And then one more piece here. Can you recognize the transience of body sensations? You know, the ways they're changing, both tuning into any single thing, it has a quality of change, or if you just kind of relax, you have one body sensation after another. Can you really be aware of that? That's one of the fundamental pieces of mindfulness of the body, we'll get to soon, which is mindful of things arising, mindful of things passing away, and mindful of both arising and passing away. Can you track that? Can you, even as you are engaged, like I'm doing it right now, can you be tuned in to the sensations that are occurring while you're functioning, while also being aware of their endless endingness? And one of the things that gets in the way of that when you really kind of come into it, which has a lot of benefits of various kinds, including enabling us to be more, have a more of a sense of connection with everything, because you're just kind of hanging out at the leading edge of now, you know, in terms of the brain, the alerting networks of the brain. It's very much like Zen practice of just sitting. You're not trying to understand anything or control anything or follow anything or label anything. You're just kind of at the leading edge of the windshield of now, you know, in terms of sensation. One scary thing that happens is you start realizing that it could all end instantaneously at any moment, and at one moment it will. And so it's weird, it's scary, because the more paradoxically you're aware of really the intensity and fullness of sensation, you become more aware that it could just stop. And then how do you get through that? And one of the ways to get through that is to come to find ways to come to peace with that inevitable, eventual reality, at least as this body. And second, it really helps to also appreciate the ongoingness of it all until it doesn't, right? It all keeps on going until it doesn't. So fear not, in a sense, right? So that's the fourth competency, if you think of it. Can you be tracking impermanence, transience, you know, in your body, in real time, continuously? Think of those as competencies, right? So then the question is, why, right? You okay with this so far? You clear about it? And you tune into it. And you might go, yep, got that one. Yep, got that one. Don't got that one. Or got that one except when I'm arguing with my partner. Right? You know, it's easy to be tuned in. I think, again, as you bring up in the back, it's easy to be tuned in if it's all okay, right? And also if you haven't had a lot of trauma in your history. But the more pain we've had, the body naturally, the mind naturally, disconnects from the body. Except later on in life, when hopefully it's hopefully safer for a person, and if not, that's a different thing, but it's hopefully safer, they hopefully have more resources, they've hopefully, you know, left those assholes behind, whatever, etc. We don't need to be so fragmented. We can actually come back into the body. We can re-inhabit ourselves. Okay? So then the question becomes why? Right? I'm just trying to work my way through. I know there's, well, other people, but I'm just going to work. So why? Well, I'll give you a couple of my whys, you know, and I think the Buddha's why. One is that when you're in touch with your body, you're less likely to do something stupid. He's so clear about that. You know, his advice to his son, you know, before you do anything, acts of thought, word, and deed, you know, reflect, will this be helpful and or hurtful? If it's hurtful, forget about it. While doing acts of mind, you know, word, thought, word, and deed, is this beneficial or not? You know, after acts of mind, thought, word, and deed, you know, was it beneficial? You know, so it's just true. The more we're not in touch with ourselves, we're more likely to do something kind of dumb. That's one thing, I think. Literally, walk into a wall, bang something, knock something over, driving while texting, you know, et cetera. Second thing is, as we come into our own bodies, we feel a more sense of wholeness ourselves. We feel more a whole person. We reclaim ourselves. We have more of a sense of integration. And the foundation of that is sensory motor processing. That's where cognition begins developmentally with infants, toddlers, and preschoolers. You know, reclaiming sensory motor processing, re-inhabiting those fundamental processes is a way to come home to ourselves. Many people, in my view, experience a kind of chronic inner homelessness. It's the new normal, and as the saying has it, you know, all sickness at bottom is homesickness. In some sense, we've left our homes, our true homes. You know, that's a way to understand many psychological maladies and physical ones as well. So that's the second benefit. You come home to yourself, you know. And I'll tell you a third benefit for me. You know, I feel like when we're born, It's as if we're given this vast estate, the entire realm of the psyche, which includes some swamps and scary places, you know, maybe some trolls are living under those bridges, but it also includes a lot of beautiful meadows, this vast estate. You know, we are the, in some sense, inheritor of it. I don't know about being the owner of it, but we've been granted this vast estate. All the sensations, all the experiences, all the feelings we could have, all the ways of being in life, you know, all the moves, the in the various games, in a good sense, with other people, right? And then bit by bit, we bump into pain, or we experience it, or we see it, or we imagine it. And then we go, oh, I'm not going into that swamp. Or, oh, better not let anyone catch me dancing in that meadow, because I get smacked down when they see how exuberant I get, right? Uh-oh. Or, oh, I better not enter that world of sensuality or physicality. Oh, better pull back from there. Oh, the province of anger? My parents have a monopoly on anger in my family. We don't get it. Don't go there. And suddenly you find yourself, metaphorically, you start out with this vast estate. You find yourself living in the gatekeeper's house, you know, behind the garage. Right? And you look out and, or you're not even aware that, wow, I'm living so much smaller than I really actually need to live in terms of my experience of things or my self-expression, my ways of being in the world, my own kind of internal freedom in, you know, in relationship to my own experience. It's sad. And that's how I felt. I contracted all the way to the upstairs bathroom of the gatekeeper's house behind the garage, or closet or something. And so for me, you know, I'm kind of motivated to reclaim my own territory and to stand up against the forces that led me to go into exile and hiding, internal exile, internal homelessness. And there's a kind of feistiness that comes. Maybe I needed to tune out my body then. Maybe I did need to throttle down my self-expression like a big valve at the neck in, you know, when I grew up. Okay. But I don't need to do that anymore. And there's a kind of fundamental fighting backness in a good sense, or sticking up for yourself in a good sense, or I've had it up to here in a good sense, or taking care of yourself as like a friend, you know, being your own personal bodyguard in a sense, in a good way, to yourself. Hey, enough of that. I'm going to reclaim. I'm going to move back out into my estate. And the pathway into that big time is your own body. How can you reclaim the estate, as it were, of all of who you are if you haven't reclaimed your own body? That's the why. That's some of the why, I think. And the part about the infinite, maybe I'll skip for the moment. Okay, questions, comments so far? Yeah.
I don't have much of a practice, but I'm working on it. And when I do use phrases, so two questions. What is the Goethe phrase that you referred to earlier?
The good phrase? Oh, waking down, not just waking up. Was that it?
Well, you didn't actually say what it was. You mentioned
Goethe.
Oh, Goethe. Yeah, he said something like commitment and the one who's committed. I don't know, something like that. There's magic in it, you know.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, it'll come. It'll somewhere.
Yeah. So act.
Yeah.
People.
Yeah.
Power.
Yeah.
The other thing is, when I do take the time, I offer to sit and not just pay attention to breathing, but try and connect to spirit, I would call it spirit. I do notice it's very enlivening, and I notice this connection between here and heart, and yeah. Oftentimes, you know, I'll find myself putting my hand on my heart.
Yeah.
And then I feel connected for those moments to everything, to spirit, and its reason for being here in those moments. It's quite remarkable. And so it makes me enlivened.
Oh, that's lovely.
In those moments. And then I get to work and I forget about it. I started writing on my hand to remind me.
Yeah.
To try to be in that space.
I think that's lovely. I think that's a fourth reason if you will, that one way people describe, it's not the only path, obviously, but of coming into the body in a funny way brings us out into everything. It's a path, it's a door into that. People do talk about that, yeah. Great, yeah, please.
Do you believe that dissociation of various types involves something like a spirit or a soul actually being outside of a body, or is that just a metaphorical figure of speech?
So you're talking about, are you talking about out-of-body experiences?
Well, no, I'm saying like when people say they're out of their body, some people mean literally there's something out of their body, and some people are using it more like a figure of speech, and I'm just curious where you stand.
My own personal opinion?
Yes.
Above my pay grade, but well, really briefly, if it's relevant, you know, minimally, it's clear that you can manipulate the sense of connection with the body, and they actually do studies now where they induce out-of-body experiences, which you can do with cameras and mirrors. It's this trippy thing. Also, epileptic seizures often produce out-of-body experiences, and you know. If you want to read a description of an apple, you know, like, how can I put it? Paul's conversion experience on the road to Damascus, one way to read that is that he had an epileptic seizure, you know, because many of the classic symptoms. I'm not speaking against what might actually have happened there, you know what I mean? But things like that can happen. So I think on the one hand, there are a lot of physical processes. Personally, I am a transcendentalist, and I have had many experiences where it was just really clear to me that more was going on than, you know, bread and butter. You know what I mean? And I'll just leave it at that. And you know, I had a guru for a while. He said, everyone's a mystic on their deathbed. Why not start sooner? That was his advice. Okay, a few more people and one more person. Then I'm going to ask you to think about something. Okay, yeah.
I'm just curious what, sort of building on that, dream state.
Yeah.
Specifically, you know, the dreams of flying. Feeling
yeah.
doing it. And usually it happens when your body is in that paralysis kind of state.
Yeah.
Does the Buddha talk about that at all?
Not in the Pali Canon, at least the text, you know, of his talks that got written down several centuries after he died. Who knows what other insertions were put in there along the way. But I think of it myself, by the way, as the Buddhist dream. Because in a sense, there's this joke that, you know, the Iliad and the Odyssey were not really written by Homer, but by another Greek with the same name. Like, does it really matter, you know? So we just take the stream, that's what we know. And then we go, is that stream have value for us? I think of myself as like a cone originating clearly with one person who had some remarkable experiences, an extraordinary talent at describing them and helping people. And he was a great yogi and a great teacher in terms of competency, you know, et cetera, as well as, in my view, fully just boom, he was awakened. It's particularly as that's defined in that framework. And anyway, that's like an origin point of a cone from there that's spread out over the world and has moved forward in time, kind of like that. So that's the Buddhist dream today. So I can't recall, I'm not a scholar of the Pali Canon, but I'm pretty familiar with it, and I can't recall anything about dreams and flying and so forth. I do recall that it is said that he said that there are four realities. Okay. There's the reality of physical form. There's the reality of the ordinary mind. There's the reality of supernatural realms. And then there's the reality of Nibbana, the unconditioned, the deathless, which is usually described as not conditioned, not caused, you know, not changing, and therefore the ultimate reliable basis for lasting happiness, profound happiness. So I suspect dreams are somewhere in there, you know, in the mind part. But I like that way of thinking about it, you know, in terms of realities. So I want to ask you a question about your relationship to your own body. You know, we can get kind of abstract about it, but do you like your body? Are you nice to your body? I haven't been that nice to my body. I haven't really abused it, but I've kind of, you know, just kept it going and pushed it to the red line of its capacities and then backed off a little and then did that again the next day. Right? So I want to kind of invite you to do something right now and see what it's like, and then we'll finish up. So you imagine your body, okay? So it's over there or it's in here. So for about a minute or so, I invite you to thank your body for various things. So if I were to do it, just stream of consciousness, a couple, three, and then I'll be quiet with you and do it with you. You know, thank you, body, for sneezing. I love the experience of sneezing. You know, like that. Thank you, body, for being able to taste chocolate. Thank you, body, for being able to kiss. I'm going oral here, obviously. You know, thank you, body, for being mainly healthy in this life, carrying me around. Thank you, body, for being able to type. It would be hard for me to do what I do without being able to type. So let's be quiet for a minute or two. Just see what happens for you around really thanking your body. And then, to finish up, a question, if you'd like to, inside your own mind, if you like, ask your body, body, is there one thing you'd like from me? And be open to the answer. May you be well and weller. See you in a little while.
Yeah, safe travels.
Thanks.